gas from Central Asia through Afghanistan into Pakistan and out to the sea. Who's going to help build the pipeline? A company called Halliburton. Who's the head of Halliburton? Cheney. This stuff starts to stink to the high heavens, especially when you look at the money that Halliburton made rebuilding Kuwait after Daddy's war over there. And who helped Halliburton rebuild Kuwait? Who made the billions and the millions off this? A company called Enron. Enron and Halliburton rebuilding Kuwait. Oh, I don't want to go there, man. This really sucks. How bad does this get? We don't want to know, do we? We don't really want to know.
It was something out of a movie. It just didn't seem real. Oh my God.
And here we see the footage. Terrorists targeting the World Trade Center, now in ruins, rubble. Thousands feared dead. And here we see the footage.
Oh my God.
Another hijacked plane which slammed into the side of the Pentagon.
The police officer told everybody to form a human chain.
And here we see the footage.
And we held on to each other, and he flashed the light, and he directed us to Building 5, and we went out Building 5.
Did you see people bleeding, and what did you see?
Oh, everybody could see. Do you want blood? Here's blood. Everybody's bleeding. People are laying all over the floor. It's horrible.
And here we see the footage.
We thought it was something out of a movie. It just didn't seem real.
Boom, boom. Oh, my God. Crack, crack. Oh, my God.
Boom, boom.
Oh, my God.
Crack, crack.
Oh, my God.
Boom, boom.
Oh, my God.
Crack, crack.
Boom, boom.
Terrorists targeting the World Trade Center, now in ruins, rubble. Thousands feared dead. And also another hijacked plane which slammed into the side of the Pentagon. Casualties there as well. And yet another hijacked plane which ended up crashing in Pennsylvania.
And I just keep seeing that airplane hitting. I saw also prior to the second airplane hitting while we were still standing there, I must have saw about 7 or 8 bodies flying through the air coming from 80 floors up. Just they fall from the debris, and you just saw them cartwheeling down, bouncing off the building. It was devastating. I'm not an emotional person in the least, and I actually felt tremendous emotion at that point.
Oh my God!
Boom boom, crack crack crack.
Boom boom,
crack 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 crack.
Boom 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 boom.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
The airplane just came in at a tilt. We heard the scream of the plane, then a crack crack crack. Boom boom boom, and the plane just disappeared. You didn't see the plane anymore, and then you saw the blowout from the other side.
It's a mood of shock. Nobody knows what to make of this at this stage. Scenes that some people are saying you wouldn't even expect to see in a movie.
We thought it was something out of a movie.
Scenes that some people are saying you wouldn't even expect to see in a movie.
Oh my God.
I have feelings of revenge.
I have feelings of revenge, but I just sure hope that the government doesn't arbitrarily select an enemy and decide to, for political reasons, obliterate that enemy just for this. But I do hope they find the people that are responsible for this.
Because I'm louder than a bomb.
I would guess the first order of business would be, what is the level of continuing threat against this country? What do we know about what may happen next? And who were these people and how do we respond?
A faceless coward. Punish. A faceless coward will be defended. Punish. Make no mistake. A faceless coward. Punish. A faceless coward will be defended. Punish. Make no mistake. The United States, a faceless coward, will hunt down freedom itself. Punish, punish, hunt down and punish.
Peace or no peace,
make no mistake. The United States, a faceless coward, responsible for for these cowardly acts. Hunt down and punish. Hunt down and punish. Make no mistake.
There's no doubt in my mind.
Punish. Make no mistake.
There's no doubt in my mind. No doubt in my mind. We'll bring Al-Qaeda to justice, peace or no peace in the Middle East.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward. And freedom will be defended.
Immediately, the name of the international terrorist, Osama bin Laden, was on everyone's tongues.
Bin Laden was trained initially by CIA operatives, and the Taliban was supported by the US as a bulwark against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. These things have come back to haunt the US.
The Taliban and Osama bin Laden.
The American demand for blood.
Pakistan. The US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
Suicide pilots.
Increasing civilian death tolls.
Bright orange flashes lighting up the night horizon.
Burning rubble.
Just a sort of one-off display of grand power politics to quiet the American demand for blood.
For 4 months, I've been waiting in vain for the North American media to pursue questions about the startling events of September 11th. Here's what I want to know. The multiple hijackings are unprecedented. The first occurs at 7:45 in the morning. It's a full hour before the first plane hits the World Trade Center. But it's an hour and 20 minutes, and after the second plane hits, that the president allegedly becomes informed. Think about that. Then he gives no orders. Why? He continues to listen to a student talk about her pet goat. Why? It's another 25 minutes until he makes a statement, even as Flight 77 is making a beeline for Washington, D.C. In the almost 2 hours of the total drama, not a single U.S. Air Force interceptor turns a wheel until it's too late. Why? Was it total incompetence on the part of air crews trained and equipped to scramble in minutes? Well, unlike the U.S. Air Force, I'll cut to the chase. Simply to ask these few questions is to find the official narrative, frankly, implausible. The more questions you pursue, it becomes more plausible that there's a different explanation. Namely, that elements within the top U.S. military, intelligence, and political leadership, which are closely intertwined, are complicit in what happened on September the 11th. Why U.S. complicity, you ask? Well, to stampede public opinion into supporting the so-called war on terrorism, to justify a war on Afghanistan for a future oil pipeline, the grab for Middle East oil and big budget increases for the military, and the general drive for global domination by the American Empire. I know it sounds incredible, but here's some historical context from this book, Body of Secrets. Its author is James Bamford. Bamford, until recently, was Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. I learned of this book on ABC's website. Bamford's information comes from interviews with, for instance, the former dean of the U.S. intelligence community and from government documents. It takes 80 pages to list Bamford's more than 600 information sources. Here's the story. It's 1962. John F. Kennedy is U.S. president. Robert McNamara is Secretary of Defense, and Admiral Lyman Lemnitzer heads the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The CIA has failed in its illegal Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. JFK decides, Bamford writes, to back away from military solutions to the Cuban problem. But Lemnitzer, the CIA, and others at the top remain obsessed with Cuba, writes Bamford. As the Kennedy brothers appeared to suddenly go soft on Cuba, Lemnitzer could see his opportunity to invade quickly slipping away. Attempts to provoke the Cuban public to revolt seemed dead. Continues Bamford, Lemnitzer and the other chiefs knew there was only one option left that would ensure their war. They would have to trick the American public and world opinion. Lemnitzer comes up with Operation Northwoods. We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation. We could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. An elaborate variation. Create an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft. The duplicate would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft will have been converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. The destruction of that aircraft will be triggered by radio signal. The Cubans would be blamed. Finally, another variation is described by Bamford. On February 20th, 1962, John Glenn was to lift off from Cape Canaveral on his historic journey. Lemnitzer proposed that should the rocket explode and kill Glenn, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with Cuba by manufacturing various pieces of evidence which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans. Thus, Bamford notes, as NASA prepared to send the first American into space, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing to use John Glenn's possible death as a pretext to launch a war. The Operation Northwoods plan shows the Pentagon was capable, according to Bamford, of launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting a war on Cuba. Can we be sure, therefore, that complicity by the Pentagon in the events of September 11th is entirely out of the question? Next week, a more precise look at the events of that fateful day. And what about Bin Laden? I'll have more on him, too, and the arrests of people named as terrorists around the world.
And I'm certainly reminded of George Orwell's three slogans on the building of the Ministry of Truth in the year 1984. He was really writing about 1948, and that was the original title of his book. But the slogans are, war is peace, ignorance is strength, and freedom is slavery. If you don't hear those reverberating somewhere in the current period, I think you need to take your earplugs out.
Good evening. You're listening to The Fish Show tonight. We present 2 hours of spoken word relating to the events leading up to and the aftermath of September 11th, 2001. Vision TV's media critic, Barry Zwicker, which you just heard. I have some bits from him. John Judge, an independent researcher in Washington, D.C., he's done work on JFK and RFK and Martin Luther King and seen release of millions of documents through his work. Greg Palast, writer and journalist for The Guardian and BBC, is an American journalist working behind the electronic Berlin Wall in England to get the stories out, as well as some Michael Moore. And I have a Michael Moore Bowling for Columbine DVD, which I'll be giving away later in this hour, and I have another one to give away later in the second hour, and I'll give you details on how you can win that later. Thanks to Gorge Video for actually giving me these. I explained what I was doing, and they said, here, have them. So, yeah, Gorge Video, there you go, my local video store, coming through, and not a corporate giant, but a local business in my neighborhood, which I'm proud to rent videos from. Tonight, spoken word, heavy stuff. You can dig it. I know you can. You are listening to The Fish Show on CFUV 101.9, 104.3 on cable around the world on the Real Audio Network.
A common explanation as to why no U.S. military interceptors took to the skies on September 11th until it was too late is that it was simple incompetence. Well, let me deal with the incompetence theory. First, by taking you back to October 26, 1999. That is the day the chartered Learjet carrying golfer Payne Stewart crashes, killing all on board. This from the National Transportation Safety Board crash report. 9:19 a.m., the flight departs. 9:24, the Learjet's pilot responds to an instruction from air traffic control. 9:33, the controller radios another instruction. No response from the pilot. For 4.5 minutes, the controller tries to establish contact. Having failed, the controller calls in the military. Note that he did not seek, nor did he require, the approval of the President of the United States, or indeed anyone. It's standard procedure, followed routinely, to call in the Air Force when radio contact with a commercial passenger jet is lost, or the plane departs from its flight path, or anything along those lines occurs. 9:54, 16 minutes later, the F-16 reaches the Learjet at 46,000 feet and conducts a visual inspection. Total elapsed time, 21 minutes. So, what does this prove? Well, it proves that standing routines exist for dealing with all such emergencies. For instance, loss of radio contact. All personnel in the air and on the ground are trained to follow the routines, which have been fine-tuned over decades, as the Learjet incident illustrates. For large scheduled aircraft, tracked throughout on radar, to depart extravagantly from their flight paths would trigger numerous calls to the military, especially after two have hit the World Trade Center and now one is speeding toward Washington, D.C. It flies over the White House, turns sharply, and heads toward the Pentagon. Everyone, and I mean everyone, now knows these planes are very bad news. It's been reported on all TV networks for more than half an hour that this is a terrorist attack. Now, Andrews Air Force Base is a huge installation. It's home to Air Force One, the President's plane. It's home base for two combat-ready squadrons of jet interceptors, mandated to ensure the safety of the U.S. Capitol. Andrews is only 12 miles from the White House. On September 11th, the squadrons there are the 121st Fighter Squadron of the 113th Fighter Wing, equipped with F-16s, and the 321st Marine Fighter Attack Squadron of the 49th Marine Air Group Detachment A, equipped with FA-18s. This information was on the website of the base on September 11th. On September 12th, Andrews chose to update its website. I find it odd that after the update, there's no mention of the F-16 and F-18 fighters. The base becomes, according to the website, home to a transport squadron only. Yet at 6:30 the evening of September 11th, NBC Nightly News, along with many outlets, reported, "It was after the attack on the Pentagon that the Air Force then decided to scramble F-16s out of the DC National Guard Andrews Air Force Base to fly a protective cover over Washington, D.C. Throughout the northeastern United States are many air bases. But that morning, no interceptors respond in a timely fashion to the highest alert situation. This includes the Andrews squadrons, which have the longest lead time and are 12 miles from the White House. Whatever the explanation for the huge failure, there have been no reports, to my knowledge, of reprimands. This further weakens the incompetence theory. Incompetence usually earns reprimands. This causes me to ask, and other media need to ask, if there were stand-down orders. Next week, Bin Laden was a longtime close ally of the CIA, according to the CIA itself. Why did he suddenly turn against them? Or did he? Stay tuned.
I'm John Judge. I'm a resident of Washington, D.C., independent investigator and researcher for many years. I'm one of the co-founders of the National Coalition on Political Assassinations, which is a network of independent researchers and investigators into the John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassination. We were responsible for passage of the JFK Records Act, which to date has released over 6 million files, the largest release of classified documents in American history. We're working now on the Martin Luther King files. And I do independent research and investigation. I don't have any particular expertise in the questions that I'm raising, other than my own history and my own work here in D.C. I am part of the baby boom in the post-war years, and I'm also someone who grew up in the shadow of the secret government in Washington, D.C., in the bedroom community in Falls Church of the NSA and the CIA and the Pentagon. My parents were civilian Pentagon employees for 30 years. My mother was five levels above top security under the Joint Chiefs. I grew up in the Pentagon. I spent time as a child in the Pentagon, and that's part of the story I'll tell you today. But briefly, the question that's been going around the press is, what did Bush or the administration know about these events, and when did they know it?
What happened on September 11th? You don't have to ask, what did Bush know and when did he know it? I mean, for Christ's sake, isn't the question, when was Bush told and how soon did he forget it?
And I would at least suggest that there is an undeniable and incontrovertible point at which Bush and the rest of the country knew in advance that the country was under attack by hijacked planes taken by terrorists or people who had the intent to use those planes as weapons, and that is 9:05 in the morning on September the 11th. And the press reported that within moments after that, in conversation with Vice President Cheney, a shoot-down order was given, official shoot-down order, for the planes that were remaining in the air. And then there is a period of almost 40 to 45 minutes, depending on which time sequences you use, but at least 40 minutes, during which Flight 77, the flight that left, turned around in Ohio and crashed into the Pentagon, was coming toward D.C. I was awakened by a call at the time of the first plane going into the first tower by someone I know here in the area who does flight administration out at Dulles. They knew that this was a very serious incident and there should not have been a plane anywhere near. By the time we began to discuss it, the second plane hit. And at that point, for most of the country, coincidence theory and accident theory were out the window. And people knew that these planes were being used as weapons. Not unprecedented, not even unprecedented by elements of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban to use planes as weapons into buildings. It's been done before in other countries, but it was being done here. And these planes, even though at some point they turned off their transponders, were under radar surveillance. They knew what direction they were headed, and even Channel 8 local TV announced here in D.C. that the planes were headed to Washington, at least one of them. And they were watching this plane come, and it's coming into, eventually, the most restricted airspace in the country and probably in the world. It's an airspace that when I grew up here in D.C., I have seen, and friends of mine have seen, commercial aircraft stray into this airspace and be confronted by interceptors that came up from local military bases or other points in the city and wagged back out of that airspace. This is an airspace that's under constant surveillance. There were some quotes that came out shortly afterwards. A Pentagon spokesperson said, "We had no mechanism to respond." I would suggest, if you're an investigative reporter, that you will find out that they have a very extensive mechanism to respond. That they don't only respond in case of a crisis emergency like this, but they respond when any commercial aircraft goes off course, even for a period of a few minutes. They have interceptors that go up to find out what's happening, why it's off course, if communication with the tower is broken, and that these are procedures that don't need any order from the president, they don't need any order from the Pentagon or anything else. These are standard FAA and NORAD procedures. It was in the press that by 8:25, they knew that an unprecedented situation, or at least relatively, it was the first I've heard of the four planes in 1970, but certainly, you know, relatively unprecedented situation of four simultaneous hijacked planes. And so there should have been some response already, just knowing that by 8:25. That didn't seem to occur. But certainly they knew that they were under a terrorist attack of some kind, and a plane was coming to D.C. It was known in advance, and they began evacuation of the Capitol. They announced it on the news. They interviewed people on the lawn of the White House who had been evacuated, and they also announced on the local news that the Pentagon was being evacuated. So they knew the targets, and they knew where it was coming. They watched it come for a long time. And then, eventually, planes were scrambled, intercept planes, from Langley Air Force Base, which is 130 miles to the south of D.C., who flew at apparently, take the distance and divide the flying time that they say, at subsonic speeds and got to the Pentagon after the plane had actually crashed into it. Regardless of whether these planes would have shot the plane down, planes should have been and could have intercepted the plane at least, wagged at it, tried to indicate it, or turn it in a particular direction, they have procedures that they follow. Another quote that came out September 23rd in Newsday from an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, Vic Wierzynski, he says that it's simply not, they simply weren't capable of understanding that the plane was heading our way. They weren't aware. They simply weren't aware that the aircraft in question was heading our way, and I doubt that prior to Tuesday's events, anyone would have expected anything like this. Now, I arranged a demonstration called A Day Without the Pentagon in the late 1990s to march from the National Cemetery to the Pentagon to contest the bloated military budget and cutting in. What a day without a Pentagon budget, in other words. I wasn't suggesting we get rid of the Pentagon by an explosion, but I was saying what would it mean if we took one day of the Pentagon's budget and put it into social services? And we marched across. Now, I had to negotiate that with about 16 different police agencies here in D.C. And I was taken by the head of security at the Pentagon into the Pentagon building. I was walked through the area where the Joint Chiefs have lunch, and I was taken out into the grounds on the parade area where we were going to be. And he said, you can't come up any further than this wall. Well, the wall was at the end of an area that doesn't come up to the steps. And I said that there had been a Supreme Court decision in the 1970s that demonstrations could come all the way up to the steps. And he said, you can't do that now because we are on Delta alert. And I said, what's that? And they said, it's our highest form of alert. And I said, why are you on alert? He said, we're getting bomb threats every day from the Muslims. And he said, we have this constant alert and you can't come any closer for security reasons. And then he pointed up the top of the building and he said, we have radar up there watching to see if any planes are coming into the building. And he said, we have photographic equipment and looked in the skies with the videos and we're going to be taping your demonstration. And I said, that's nice, could we get a copy? This is the late 1990s. Did they go back to sleep? They have the equipment to know whether something's coming. In addition to that, my parents used to take me to lunch during the day in the center area of the Pentagon, in the courtyard at the middle. And I remember asking my father when I was young what certain things were there, and there were surface-to-air missile batteries in that area that defend the building. It's also the case after the Piper Cub that flew into the White House hit, that surface-to-air missile battery was built on the White House lawn in order to protect that building. This plane came into the restricted airspace, it flew over the White House and the Capitol, and then it took a 270-degree looping turn coming down from 5,000 feet. Nothing in its way. You could pick the simplest thing on an operation you would think would go to the nearest side of the Pentagon, but it went out of its way to hit the empty side of the Pentagon. And I think they studied it. There was something in the news last week that Muhammad Atta had a miniaturization of the Pentagon that he was carrying around in some public place. Anybody who's anywhere near the Pentagon in the last 6 years, even back in the late 90s when I was there, knows that that's the side of the Pentagon that's empty and that's being under construction. And so they went out of their way to come all the way around the Pentagon. There's nothing blocking their way to go into any other side and hit that side. But the entire time, they were completely unchallenged. Now, is it the case, as they were saying, that they have no mechanism, that they didn't have any scrambling planes available here in D.C.? Absolutely not. Andrews Air Force Base, which is 10 miles away from here, has both the 121st Fighter Squadron of the 113th Fighter Wing, F-16s, multiple planes, equivalent of two squadrons of combat-ready fighter jets at Andrews Air Force Base. They also house the 321st Marine Fighter Attack Squadron, the 49th Marine Air Guard, which defends the airspace over the D.C. area, and F-18s, that are combat ready. In addition to that, there is Anacostia Naval Air Station, which houses the DC National Air Guard and DC National Guard, and they have combat ready jets. These jets are in the air now, after the fact, actively defending the United States. Where were they on September the 11th? Why was nothing put up in the way of this flight? Is it the case then, perhaps, that there was some sort of a stand down? I have a few indications of that. There is a 177th Air National Guard based out of Pomona, New Jersey, near Atlantic City at the Atlantic City Airport. They're about equidistant, actually a little closer to DC. They could cover both Manhattan and DC. They have fighter ready intercept jets. But one investigator that talked to them said that they were told 2 weeks prior to the event to stop putting the jets up in the air on a regular basis. I also talked to an independent journalist and investigator at the Pentagon whose response to my stand-down thesis that I'm giving you, he said, didn't you read in the New York Times, and I've not been able to find this article, so maybe he miscited it, that 3 days before September 11th, half of the combat-ready planes in the United States were taken down offline. I said, I did not. Are you making your argument or mine? And then there's a third indication I have from someone whose son is stationed at Otis Air Force Base. The son has talked to pilots who were in the air the hour that the second plane was hit, scrambled out of Otis, who turned their attention to Flight 77, the Pentagon flight, and made clear that they were going to go to try to intercept that flight coming back across from Ohio to D.C. and were called back, according to these pilots, were called back off the flight by the command. So was there a stand down and no response? Were there callbacks? These are not questions that I ultimately have the resources to answer, but they're questions that stand and that raise for me a much deeper level of this scenario than is being addressed. But was there a point at which they knew ahead? There certainly was. And for 40 minutes, everybody in D.C. knew the plane was coming, and we didn't do a thing.
What am I afraid of? I'm afraid that this coming to a place like Boulder or any of the other cities I go to on this tour, that after I go, nobody will do anything. I'm afraid that you're here tonight looking at me as somebody who's going to lead something. And this will never happen if we exist in a celebrity culture where, you know, a Michael Moore or a Ralph Nader or whoever is going to make this happen. It will only happen if you get off your ass and do something. That's what I'm afraid of. I'm not afraid of the boogeyman Osama bin Laden, you know, because I haven't fallen for this since about day three of the new war, you know. This is what I'll tell you, here's what totally changed my attitude about this. I was reading a story in the Washington Post, I don't know, it was a few days after. Buried deep in the story is a paragraph that says Osama bin Laden is on dialysis. Are you aware of this? So you mean you're telling me that this guy who's the mastermind of all the evil in the world, he is everywhere. He could be in this room tonight. Oh, oh. You're telling me that the evildoer is hooked up to a kidney machine in a cave in Afghanistan? We're going to go over there and bomb the shit out of this country and kill civilians to find a guy who's running from cave to cave hooked up to a dialysis machine? Am I stupid? Are we stupid? Yes or no? There seems to be a split decision in here.
President Bush said all nations had to unite to oppose all terrorists.
Any government that rejects this principle, trying to pick and choose its terrorist friends, will know the consequences.
Do the Americans see that what they are experiencing is not unique?
I think that it's not. It is inevitably, the superpower sees itself as in a very special position. And what I find intriguing is that both there's a talk we need to build a coalition against terrorism. So going against the normal U.S. unilateral position. And at the same time, there is this sense that the American suffering is quite unique.
Don't believe the hype.
Well, I agree with
people who say that this was a historic event. For one thing, the act itself had the most devastating instant human toll of any crime that I can think of in history, outside of war, that is. But we have to put the stress on the word instant. Unfortunately, it is not an act of terror that is unique in scale. In fact, far from that.
The United States, as an individual power, spends more on military budget than does all other countries in the world combined.
The national territory was conquered with the elimination of millions of people. Half of Mexico was conquered. There were depredations throughout the region. Hawaii was taken from its inhabitants. Philippines were conquered, a couple hundred thousand killed. And since the Second World War, it's extended all over the world. But the guns were always pointed in the other direction.
What will the United States do if it has to turn the spotlight on its own sponsorship of terrorism in the recent past? It's not all that long ago that Bill Clinton, for instance, was apologizing for American support for terrorism in Guatemala and Honduras.
Don't believe the hype.
And I guess there'd be plenty of Cambodians who would put their hands up and claim to be victims of state-sponsored terrorism. Which raises the question, I hate to even ask the question, but is it valid to make a distinction between what looks like amateur terrorism on the one hand and state-sponsored terrorism on the other?
Well, the definition of terrorism is simply activities that in public places or against the state in public arenas that are designed to intimidate and frighten. So it's a very, very broad definition, and there is really no distinction legally between state-sponsored terrorism and other forms.
Europe did not take over the world by polite means. And over those centuries, India did not attack England, and Algeria didn't attack France, and the Congo didn't attack the Belgium, and so on. It was the other way.
Don't believe.
This is the first significant case where really large-scale atrocities were carried out with the usual conquerors being the victims.
Handling mail?
The United States.
Precautionary decontamination showers.
Letters that come from somebody you may not know, unmarked letters, letters that have got, that look suspicious.
Osama bin Laden is not an easy subject. Characterizations of him vary wildly. The most common, because it's the official narrative of cardboard cutout simplicity, is that he's the world's number one villain, the diabolical mastermind behind the events of September 11th. Another view, Osama is the conscience of Islam. Well, globally, Osama is like a Rorschach inkblot. His character and role morph into what various publics project upon him, based on what they're led to believe. Take books. There's an adage you can't tell a book by its cover. Maybe so, but you can tell it by its index. Bin Laden, the man who declared war on America, is by Yosef Budansky, former senior consultant to the Pentagon and U.S. State Department. Budansky explains a vast global conspiracy, it says in the foreword. The index entries on bin Laden in this 440-page book run almost two pages. But there are just four references to the CIA, mostly brief, and they reveal nothing. Yet the decades-long $8 billion CIA covert operation in Afghanistan was also its largest ever, according to numerous sources, including journalist John Cooley in his book, Unholy Wars, Afghanistan, America, and International Terrorism. Contrast the Budansky book with this one, Taliban, by Ahmed Rashid. He's a Pakistani journalist who's covered Afghanistan for 21 years. In his index are 8 entries about bin Laden and 11 about the CIA. Now back to bin Laden. What do most sources agree on? We know bin Laden is born in Saudi Arabia in 1957. Okay, we're not sure about the year. His father becomes a close friend of the king and fabulously wealthy. Bin Laden Corporation becomes one of the largest construction companies in the Middle East. In this business, you're dealing with the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, Saudi intelligence, the CIA. With his family's blessing, Osama becomes closely associated with the CIA in the Afghan war against the Soviets. Bin Laden Corp, Ahmed writes, built major training camps for the CIA. In 1986, he helped build the Coast Tunnel Complex, which the CIA was funding as a major arms storage depot, training facility, and medical center for the Mujahideen. At this point, bin Laden's story, like Stephen Leacock's horse, rides madly off in all directions. My questions: did he turn against the CIA? Maintain ties while making anti-American statements? Was he manipulated? Former associates describe him as deeply impressionable, always in need of mentors, Rashid writes. You're forced to turn to a larger canvas, as in the final draft of this to-be-published book, The War on Freedom, Causes and Consequences of 9/11, by Nafiz Ahmed, executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in Brighton, England. He's an Oxfam campaigner who specializes in writing international reports on human rights. News of his reports have been carried by Reuters, Associated Press, The Guardian, The Independent, The Jewish Chronicle, and the London Jewish News. Ahmed writes that bin Laden is merely a piece in a chess game. The stakes of the game are the last of the world's oil reserves and the Bush administration's consolidation of power to pursue a drastic, unlimited militarization of foreign policy on a massive and unprecedented scale required by long-standing elite planning while crushing domestic dissent and criminalizing legitimate protest. I believe that if we shrink from testing Ahmed's overview and accept only the headlines of the day, we will fail to see the forest for the trees. The USA helped recruit, train, and equip thousands of killer Mujahideen in the anti-Soviet war. Ahmed's book and other evidence shows the recruiting of and training of terrorists, including those in Al-Qaeda, has continued for years. The White House went underground with this aid. This is detailed in the 1993 book, The Outlaw Bank, A Wild Ride into the Secret Heart of BCCI. BCCI stands for Bank of Credit and Commerce International. It collapsed after exposure of its massive fraud and corruption. The book's authors are Jonathan Beatty and S.C. Gwynn. Beatty was an investigative reporter and senior correspondent for Time magazine. Gwynn, Time's economics editor and author of Selling Money. Further evidence of the long and deep involvement of the CIA in terrorism is found in the 1987 book, Crimes of Patriots, A True Tale of Dope, Dirty Money, and the CIA, by Jonathan Quitney. Quitney, at the time, had been a Wall Street Journal reporter for 16 years. He wrote that neither the director of the CIA nor the deputy director had, in his career, shown any reluctance to shed American or foreign blood in covert military operations. The book details how some of the biggest names in American defense and intelligence were involved in an operation that promoted the dope trade, tax evasion, and gun running. Michael Springman is a Washington lawyer. He worked for the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service for 20 years. He spent 2 years as chief of the visa section at the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He says superiors repeatedly ordered him to issue visas to unqualified applicants. It was illegal. He protested. He's just written this article in the reputable Covert Action Quarterly of Washington, D.C., and was interviewed by the CBC radio program Dispatches. I had not been protesting fraud. What I was protesting was, in reality, an effort to bring recruits, rounded up by the agency and Osama bin Laden, to the U.S. for terrorist training by the CIA. He details numerous cases. The State Department did not run the consulate in Jeddah. The CIA did. Of the roughly 20 Washington Dispatch staff there, I know for a certainty that only three people, including myself, had no ties, either professional or familial, to any of the U.S. intelligence services. Now, what bugs me to no end is that mainstream media journalists function as if these books, written by the most professional in their own ranks, they function as if these books don't exist. Fellow journalists, the dots exist. For goodness sakes, connect them while you can. There are plenty of what we call in the news business pigs, solid current evidence, new dots. But these dots, past and present, are never connected. Take this November 22nd front page story in the Globe and Mail. I almost missed the startling information in this myself because the headline indulges a stereotypical Canadian self-put-down. Us stupid Canadians, we let a terrorist, one Ali Mohammed, get away. The real story is buried. Mr. Mohammed was a U.S. Army sergeant, but trained bin Laden's bodyguards. What? Ali Mohammed was in the Americans' good books. Ali Mohammed wasn't so shadowy in those days. He was one of their guys. The headline on this story might have read, USA protected top Al-Qaeda operative, and it might well have been the banner. Author Nafiz Ahmed's own conclusion is that the documentation strongly suggests the United States, or more precisely, significant elements of the U.S. government, military, and intelligence, had extensive foreknowledge of the 11th September attacks and were in various ways complicit in those attacks. All this and more must be considered when asking what really happened on September 11th. And where is bin Laden, you ask? Have journalists stopped asking? Why? Journalist and former Los Angeles Police Department detective Michael Rupert quipped recently, "One guess is that he's in Switzerland having his nails done." Next week, George W. Bush and the oligarchy.
I can't take it anymore. You know, it's like, then I pick up the November 12th New Yorker. I'm not really a big fan of this magazine, but there it is. I pick it up. There's an article by Jane Mayer. You know what the article says? That in the days after September 11th, when nobody could fly, when all the planes were grounded, right? Nobody flew. Everything grounded. There was one private plane that flew around the skies of the United States of America. A private Saudi jet that went to four or five American cities to pick up about two dozen members of the bin Laden family and their associates. Are you aware of this? What the hell is that all about? I mean, I don't have the answer. I'm not really trying to draw any conclusions. But what is that about? What is that about? What do you mean? What? The FBI was furious. I mean, they told the Bush administration, hey, wait a minute. We're conducting a police investigation here. There's been a mass murder. Usually in a murder case, the police like to go and talk to the relatives. What do you know? Who do you know? What does he know? Where do you think he is? What can you tell us? How can you help us? Typical, right? Typical everyday police work, right? The FBI wanted to ask those questions. The Bush administration said, no, you are not to talk to a single bin Laden, and they are scooted out of the country. What is that all about? I would like to know, Mr. Bush. I'd like to know the financial connections between your family and the bin Laden family over the years. No. Oh, no. Let's go back before the Carlyle Group. Let's go to Arbusto. Arbusto. This is George W.'s first little oil venture that Daddy set him up with, you know, when he wasn't working for the first 18 years of his adult life. You know, you got to go to work. I'm going to set you up with a little company, Arbusto, Spanish for bush. Although I think it's actually Spanish for shrub, but it's some conglomeration of weeds. Arbusto. Who was one of the main financial backers of Arbusto? The bin Laden family. This is back in the 80s, folks. Carlyle Group, George Sr.'s little company he sets up after he leaves the White House with James Baker. Okay? So, and a bunch of other cronies of theirs, Carlucci and a bunch of others, and Major, John Major from Britain. It's a private equity firm, and they do investments, and they line up defense contracts. And who's one of their biggest clients? The bin Laden family. When George Sr. goes to stay in Saudi Arabia, he stays at the bin Laden Palace.
You know, where they, there's pictures of this. There's these little sleepovers at the Bin Ladens. And is this just a coincidence? Is something wrong with me? You know, the 6 billion people on this planet, you got two families, the Bushes and the Bin Ladens. One runs one country. One's trying to kill the people in that country. What's this up? What's this, just a coincidence? And they're friends, but yet there's something with the sons. What's this all about? I don't know. I'd like to know. Wouldn't you like to know? 15 of the 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia, yet we bomb Afghanistan. Did we miss? Did we, like, lob something and just whoop? Oh, we hit Afghanistan. No? As Ralph said the other day, we went over there to burn down a haystack to find a needle, and we couldn't find the needle. Wow. That's interesting. Isn't that strange? 15 of the 19 are from Saudi Arabia. Can't bomb the oil supply, can we? Can't bomb the business partners of Poppy, can we? Can't do that. You know, 15 of the 19 hijackers are from Cuba. Imagine this. 15 of the 19 from Cuba. Would we be bombing Peru? Exactly. You would laugh at that, wouldn't you? But how many people in this country accepted, yep, we got to go over there and bomb Afghanistan? Why? Because of the way they mistreated their women? Oh, we're suddenly concerned about that in Afghanistan? Hello, United States of America? You know? How about our buddies in Saudi Arabia? You know how they celebrated New Year's Day in Saudi Arabia this year? Chopped off the heads of 3 gay guys because they were gay. Yeah, that's our ally. That's our partner. Saudi Arabia has not let the FBI into the country, not once since September 11th, to ask a single question of anybody. They will supply none of the documents. They will supply none of the stuff that shows the funding of Al-Qaeda from Saudi Arabia. They will not cooperate one single bit. Why? Because this was a military operation. It was a military operation conducted by elements within the Saudi regime. Friends, possibly, or not friends. Or maybe the deal went south. Because if you go to the BBC website in 1995, it's right there. Look it up on the web. 1995, Houston oil executives host a Taliban delegation in Houston. George W. Bush, governor of Texas. They're there to discuss the Unocal pipeline. They want to build a pipeline through Afghanistan to bring the natural gas from Central Asia through Afghanistan into Pakistan and out to the sea. 40% of the known natural reserves of natural gas on this planet are in Central Asia. So this is a big-ass deal. And they work with the Taliban for a number of years trying to make this thing happen. Who's going to build the pipeline? Who's going to help build the pipeline? A company called Halliburton. Who's the head of Halliburton? Big Dick Cheney. Okay, this stuff starts to stink to the high heavens, especially when you look at the money that Halliburton made rebuilding Kuwait after Daddy's War over there. And who helped Halliburton rebuild Kuwait? Who made the billions and the millions off this? A company called Enron. Enron and Halliburton rebuilding Kuwait. Oh, I don't want to go there, man. This really sucks. How bad does this get? We don't want to know, do we? We don't really want to know. Because if we really know, if the American people really know, they just might get so depressed, they'll just check out entirely. 50% already don't vote. How many won't vote after that? How many will just say, forget it. They're all corrupt. This is the sickest thing I've ever seen. I don't want anything to do with it. Or will they rise up and say, you know what? This is still our country. And you, Bush, you're the one who's unpatriotic. You're the one who's not the American. You're the one who is destroying this country. You, Bush. You use the cover of September 11th to try and get a tax bill for the rich under the cover of September. Oh, because of September 11th, we got to give more tax breaks, give more money back to the rich. That's your answer to that, Bush. Let's build more bombs. Let's give Lockheed the biggest contract ever given to a military contractor because of September 11th. A new stealth fighter bomber. What's that going to do? Stop the next box cutter? You know, if it's the box cutters you're worried about, if it's the guy with the lighted shoes, you know, just as an aside, last time I saw a guy light his shoes on fire was a Motley Crue concert. It was around 87, 88. Some kid just puked on his own shoes and flew a match down there, and the old shoe lit up. It was wild. It appears that was a real deal, and the guy, you know, had plastic explosives in his shoe, and he was going to light his shoe. Now, have you flown since then? Have you flown since Mr. Lighted Shoes? Have you flown? Yeah, what can't you bring through onto the plane? Toe clippers, nail clippers, pens, pencils, anything pointed, a needle. What else? What else are they? Safety pins, wire bras. I mean, it was just, no, I mean,
It's really, I mean, there's a whole long list of things. You know what you can bring through? A butane lighter and a pack of matches. In fact, you can bring a box of matches if you want. Now, why is that? Because the FAA had put the butane lighters and the matches on, or the butane lighters on the list, the original list. Bush took it off. Bush, Ashcroft, FAA, they took it off. Why'd they take it off? Tobacco companies lobbied Bush and said, you take the butane lighters and the matches off, you're going to hurt our business. Yeah, you know the story? No, of course not. Yeah, no. It's okay. Nobody wants to write the story, right? I mean, just think about that. What is, you know, that's a legitimate thing, I guess, that somebody actually did try to blow up a plane with that. You can break the butane out of there and start a nice little fire if you wanted to, right? Why do you need a butane lighter and matches on an airplane to begin with? You can't smoke on it. So why do you need them, you know? But they'll listen to the tobacco companies first before they do anything to really actually try and protect us. They're not about protecting us, all right? They're trying to create what Orwell called the permanent war. I mean, this guy was like a f***ing genius, you know? I mean, I couldn't, you know, this is like the permanent, go back to 1984. It's the permanent war. The way to get the public completely, I mean, willing to give up their rights is to have them constantly afraid of some external enemy that's out there that you can't see, but it's always there and is never going away. That's the war on terrorism. That's what they need us all freaked out about. Yeah, why did we give $43 million of our tax money to the Taliban in Afghanistan last May? Check it out, May 22nd, LA Times. Yeah, that's right, because the Taliban signed on to the drug war. So we gave them $43 million of our tax money after we said they helped the people that blew up the USS Cole and the African embassies. If the average American knew that or understood that, how furious would they be? Think about that. $43 million of their money went to the so-called terrorists. Why? Because it was a bailout for the poppy farmers. The Taliban said to Bush, we'll join the war on drugs. So they signed up. And then they said, but our poppy farmers are going to be hurting now. So the Bush administration gave them money for a bailout to help the poppy farmers, you know. And this is really what's great about America. We'll bail out the airlines. We'll bail out Chrysler. We'll bail out the people who send the heroin to the United States.
You are listening to The Fish Show on CFUV 101.9, 104.3 on cable, around the world on the Real Audio Network, and live here tonight. So you're listening to different spoken word bits about the aftermath of September 11th, including censorship, relinquishment of freedoms, and general media, what would you call it?
Scallywaggery,
exactly.
Scallywaggery.
All night we're going to be playing this stuff, and it'll be available on the internet in the next couple of days. I'll be putting it up on the website, so you can download it. And if you want special copies, I'm sure we can arrange that sort of thing. Give us a call at 721-8700 right now. We've got two things. We've got a promo. Next Saturday.
Yes. We've got... there's a show at the Second Story.
Second Story. Blackout Orchestra.
Is going to be there. It's an indie rock... all indie rock program that evening. Mm-hmm. So we don't know the time it starts. And I imagine there'll be 3-4 bands, something like that. Mm. Cheap.
Yeah, and so this looks like it's going to be good. And the second thing we have is Huge Bus Now, the Fish Show movie directed by Theodore Trout, going to be premiering at Lucky Bar. You know where it is? September 27th. Now, which day is that?
I believe that's a Saturday night, isn't it?
Is it?
But it's an early show.
Ah.
It's an early show, 7:30. And there's something else after it. Maybe it's a Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
It's right near the end of the Antimatter Festival. It's actually the same night as the end of the Antimatter Festival.
Okay, good. Well, this is good because you can go there. It's $5. It's cheap. And this is the story of our friend Hal and his...
1963 Detroit Diesel powered.
Yes. And it was co- converted to burn?
Used deep fryer oil, of all things. So you could take, like, schmeggy Tim Hortons donut grease.
Yeah.
Run it through a cheesecloth filter.
Yeah.
And burn it. And then power your vehicle.
Yeah.
It's kind of it's an interesting concept.
And it smells good, too.
Don't lie about the smell. It comes out the back end. It reeks to high heaven. Of course, but, you know, it you're replacing diesel. You know, it's potato, potato there. They both stink pretty bad.
Potato, deep fried potato. Oh. So this is the story of the bus that went from Victoria to St. John's and back.
St. John's, Newfoundland, and back.
All documented on video and directed and edited by Theodore Trout. Presented September 27th at Lucky Bar. Head down there. Check it out. Right now, I'm going to give away a DVD copy of Bowling for Columbine. Wow. I got from my local video store, Gorge Video, because they're great people. And they're a bulwark against the corporate Jolly Rogers, which is just up the street. And they're doing well. And they get in stuff that Jolly Roger would never think about doing. So I have a skill testing question.
We got a phone ringing already. We haven't even given the question yet.
Got to give the question before we answer.
You got to wait till you get the question.
And the question is, can you name two movies outside of Bowling for Columbine that Michael Moore directed?
Oh.
Or the name of two books that he wrote, or the name of his two TV shows. So that's pretty simple.
They must have a pair, so they can't go like TV show book, right? It's got to be two TV shows, two books, or two movies.
That's right.
Okay.
So phone in 721-8700. We got another copy to give away later, later this hour. So phone in. We're gonna get right back to some more spoken word here.
Now they're calling again.
Okay, you're listening to the Fish Show on CFUV 101.9, 104.3 on cable.